Christopher Wilkins is a prisoner in Texas. If the state has its way, he'll be dead within the hour. This is Executioner Watch. Huntsville, Texas, death penalty capital of the Western world, where prison staff is preparing to put Wilkins to death by injecting him with a deliberate drug overdose. During the next hour, KPFT's Executioner Watch will broadcast live coverage of the killing in Texas, the state responsible for nearly half of all executions in the U.S. Executioner Watch host Ray Hill, Chief Legal Analyst Jim Skelton, with Legal Analysts Larry Douglas, Mike Gillespie, and Paige Yannick. Guest commentator Timothy Bass, Huntsville reporter outside the death house Pat Hartwell, Houston Vigil reporter Jennifer Simmons. The Executioner Watch for Christopher Wilkins begins. Killing people, don't you know they're killing people, don't you know they're killing people.
Greetings, this is Ray Hill. I see a light flashing on the telephone, so I assume that is Pat Hartwell. And if it is, will somebody put her on the air? Pat?
Yes.
What's going on in Huntsville?
Well, it's a little noisy here. The music is going off that they started during the execution. I was just told that it's called Sweet Hour of Prayer. How appropriate.
Okay,
media has crossed, but his witnesses have not crossed yet, and we don't know why.
Well, as far as any of us know, there's nothing pending at this time, except maybe a last minute clemency, which never happens.
Just a minute. Here comes some more. It's getting dark out here. Let me get a little closer. The loudspeaker was going off. I couldn't hear over there. I'm going to have to put it up. Yes, here comes his ex-wife and Allison from Austin and Nancy, his friend that frequently visits from Amarillo. They're going to witness.
Okay,
so we know it's going on, unfortunately.
So this is Pat, it's been a long sabbatical. I mean, we've gone, over 3 months now, and this is the first one?
Well, it's been well over 3 months. It's been since April.
Yeah.
It's not a long enough sabbatical.
I know. We're never going to be happy with
sabbatical. We've got eight more on the list after Christopher tonight. And,
okay.
Unfortunately, we don't know what's going to happen.
While I've got you on the air, I want to remind the listeners that Pat Hartwell is a regular feature of the Prison Show, which is broadcast every Friday night on this very same station and network from 9 until 11 o'clock. So, Pat, I'm sorry you've got this duty, but thank you for covering it for us.
I will, and I will call back when the witnesses come out. I'm sorry it's happened, and my sympathies go to all of his buddies on the road.
Thank you, ma'am.
Uh-huh. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Well, this one's begun.
Yep.
What about this case?
Well, it's not very complicated. Christopher Willis, and I never could, I'm Wilkins, I'm sorry. I never could figure out why he ended up in TDC to begin.
We got a call from the Houston demonstration. Put Jennifer on. Jennifer?
I'm here, Ray.
Jennifer, and here is...
I'm at the corner of Shepherd and Westheimer, in front of St. Anne's Catholic Church. I would just like to correct one thing I just heard. We had an execution in October, November of last year.
Yeah, I thought this was a 3-month sabbatical, and then when Pat threw me that curve, you never know what to do when somebody throws you a curve and you're on the air.
We don't often correct that, but I didn't want that to go unnoticed.
Okay.
We have 7 or 8 people here.
All right.
It's a very good vigil. Some people are here that we have not seen before. I'm having a little trouble talking here because there's a very bad echo. So I'm having some difficulty. I would like to tell the listeners that there will be a TCADC concert in February 19th. And it will be very good, and we invite everyone to come to that in August.
Where is the conference going to be held?
The conference will be in Austin.
Austin, okay.
Austin.
And they can come to the website for information.
Yes, ccadc.org.
That stands for Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty.
Yes.
That's www.tcadp.org.
.org. Okay. Listen, there is Daniel here from the prison show has requested to say a few words in Spanish, if that is okay with
that
you.
That is always appropriate.
Okay. And I'll let him close out the report here in Houston.
Thank you,
ma'am.
Okay.
Here's Daniel.
Buenas noches, Daniel.
Buenas noches. ¿Qué tal estamos?
Go on. It's your time.
Muy bien, pues. Os saluda a toda la comunidad latina, a todos los hispánicos. Para recordarnos que estamos aquí en las calles de Houston, en Shepherd y Westheimer, que somos unas 10 personas y estamos protestando para que termine esta barbarie que tenemos en nuestro estado de Texas. Un abrazo a todos y te devuelvo la línea back to line to you at KPFT 90.11 Houston.
Thank you, Daniel. And Daniel and Pat Hartwell are part of the prison show. This is not your usual case.
It's very unusual. He was from the Houston area. And what happened, he ended up going to TYC, and I never could find out what... TYC means Texas Youth Corrections, a nice word for being reform school. I never could find out what happened. He also, after he got there, ended up doing some federal time, but I couldn't find out what that offense was for. And what happened, after he's doing his federal time, he was paroled to a halfway house in Beaumont. Because of Hurricane Rita, they transferred him to Houston, where his wife and children lived. While he was in Houston, he got a day pass to see his family. And what he did, he ended up stealing a pickup truck and going to Fort Worth. Why? Nobody knows. Gets to Fort Worth, he runs into a guy by the name of Willie Freeman. He was a street person. And he wants to buy some cocaine from Willie Freeman. Willie Freeman apparently had a deal going. There was a guy named Mike Silva that used to come into Fort Worth, and Willie Freeman would get dope for Mike Silva, and they'd split it. So together, these two guys, Silva and Freeman, sold him some dope, but it really was a piece of gravel. And after he paid him $20 for it, they laughed at him, made fun of him. And at that time, nothing happened, but apparently what he and Freeman became pretty good friends and started hanging out together. And Freeman later apologized for what he had done and gave him some more dope. Apparently, he carried some sort of grudge with him, because a couple of weeks later, he tells Freeman and Silva both, I know where there's some guns and dope that we can rip off. And they drive to that location. They're driving in Silva's car. Silva and Freeman are in the front. He's in the back seat. Drive out to deserted area. To his direction, he shoots Freeman in the back of the head with a pistol. At that point, Silva tries to get out of the car. He's driving. He jumps, tries to jump out of the car, and at this point, he gets shot in the head twice and in the shoulder and gets tangled up in the seatbelt. And so Wilkins shoves him out of the car, and he's still tied to the seatbelt and takes off driving. The guy's body's dangling out of the car as he's driving down the highway. It's kind of like that. You remember years ago, there was a record driver here in Houston that killed a guy and put him on the back of the record and drove around town with him for a while. It's kind of one of those deals. Then he cut the seatbelt and dumped both bodies. And then what happened, they reported the car stolen. He was caught in the stolen car. And they discovered after they found him, he admitted everything. He never made bones about it. But he also did something very odd. He also admitted the day before he killed these two men, Freeman and Silva, that he also shot and killed another man named Viejos. And the reason he killed him, they got into argument over a telephone call, over getting in a telephone booth. So he ended up killing three people in about a 36-hour period, made a complete full confession to the police, and Paige is going to discuss what he did at trial, because basically he pretty well admitted everything at trial.
There was nothing to talk about, guilt or innocence. No. All this is about sentencing.
Nothing at all. Paige is going to talk about how crazy stuff he did at trial.
Well, they did, at trial, they did have a trial on guilt or innocence, much to the chagrin of Mr. Wilkins. Mr. Wilkins wanted to plead guilty and just go straight to the punishment phase and decide whether he was going to get life or death. And he got really, really angry at his lawyers. The very idea of his lawyer not doing precisely what he wanted him to have done. And he believed that the lawyers were perhaps double-crossing him because they were trying to pad their billable hours. Excuse me.
While you catch up on that, I need to tell people that Susan is over in the other studio, and I mean Susan Darrow, and she's doing her regular program Border Music over there. Because we're on the broadcast channel, she's on HD Channel 3. If you don't have an HD radio, then you can use your friendly internet-connected device. Go to kpft.org and check the link for HD3, and you'll find Susan playing the usual collection of wonderful music. Okay, I'm sorry, Paige, to interrupt, but I should have done that up front. I'm just playing catch up.
Not a problem at all, Ray. Anyway, so all of the evidence of punishment involved various issues in Mr. Wilkins's life and his appearance. The state started out with his tattoos, talking about he had a life-size depiction of Hitler on his chest, and he had swastikas, and that he was a gang member. And Mr. Wilkins pretty much poo-pooed this, saying that once upon a time he might have been part of the Dirty South Nazi gang, but most of the tattoos now that he had gotten in prison were purely camouflage so that he could blend in with everybody else he was hanging out with. Then the prosecutors and he talked about how he had concealed a handcuff key by swallowing it and had concealed a handmade knife and was planning to employ these when he had his next appointment with the police detective, Detective Cheryl Johnson, and how perhaps he was about to escape. Then they introduced a handwritten letter that he had where he stated that he just planned on killing more people once he got out of jail. And, he was talking about some white supremacy phraseology in the interior contents of the document. But he basically just said that he was going to go ahead and just kill people at random, and that race may, but probably wasn't the biggest factor in determining who he was going to kill. Then he talked about how he had no real commitment to continuing on in his life. He said he didn't care whether the jury chose to put him to death.
He said this in front of the jury?
Yes, in front of the jury. He didn't care whether the jury chose to put him to death or to give him life without parole. And he was going to be fine with either decision, and he understood the jury had a job to do, and he wanted the jury to go forth and prosper.
He gave him absolution.
Yeah, go forth and prosper, and I made these bad decisions, and the truth of the matter is I would have made them anyway.
Well, he didn't have a trial on guilt or innocence because, well, he had one, but he didn't want one.
Yeah.
And then he blew whatever it was to do at sentencing.
And
but it was basically his own doing.
No, he all but sent out an engraved invitation.
Well, you know, what gets me about this is that there's a recent parallel. I mean, we've got this guy who went in the church and killed those folks. It's the same story.
Oh, you mean the South Carolina case?
What's his name?
Dylan Rolfe, I believe.
Roof.
Roof. Yeah, Dylan Roof. The Dylan Roof case is this case in a different circumstance.
And don't forget, Ray, we had the case over in Fort Bend County years ago where a defendant tells a jury at punishment, if you don't give me the death penalty, I have all your names and addresses, I'll come back and kill you.
Didn't we do that show?
We didn't do that. It was a long time ago.
But yeah, but it seemed like Lurch. Remember Lurch?
Oh, Lurch, yeah.
It told the jury basically the same
yeah.
thing.
Well, they did. This guy, he's like, I got your names, addresses. If you don't give me the death sentence, I'm going to come back and kill all of you. And guess what?
They gave him the death sentence,
and guess what? He got executed. Yeah, so.
Well, Mr. Wilkins did everything he could possibly in front of the jury in order to get them to decide
Paige.
Death.
You got to read tea leaves here. He didn't care. He didn't place a value on his own life. Therefore, why should he place a value on other people's life?
I think that may be true. He seemed, from everything I've read, to have been stuck at a 10-year-old age of development.
The most dangerous person in the world is somebody who does not value their own life.
Well, he definitely was dangerous in his case.
Ray, he was ADD as a child and wasn't treated. Mike and I were talking about that. And his entire life as a kid, he was told to shut up, be still, had trouble at school because he was real active. And back then, Mike and I talked about, they didn't medicate kids. So as a child, he was pretty well told to shut up, quit being still, don't be moving. And I'm sure a lot of that built up pent-up anger. Then plus he goes to TYC, and that didn't exactly...
Yeah, that don't help.
No, that doesn't help.
No.
A big problem, though, is what do you do as a lawyer?
How old is this guy now?
He's 44.
44 now? Mm-hmm. And so when did this actually happen?
He was 37 when it happened.
37 when it happened. So he wasn't a kid. He was a grown man. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And Larry and I were talking about this, the real problem. What do you do with a lawyer with a client like this? It's a big...
You got the bad seat in the house. You got to pretend you're his lawyer. What the hell do you do?
Well, I wouldn't want to just try to Monday morning quarterback what this lawyer did. But in terms of trying to handle someone like Christopher Wilkins as a client, the client actually controls the show. And it appeared that he was trying to commit suicide by the system rather than by cop. He was having the system execute him. Now, there would be some problems for me. Not that I'd have a problem with him, but he'd probably have a problem with me. Okay, this is a Confederate skinhead guy.
Yeah, sure. I can see a problem evolving.
So, I'm black, he's white, he killed a black guy, an Hispanic guy. He says, I'm not racist, but, there might have been, probably were some racial
elements. That's what Sessions said today. I saw him on television.
And I know a few years ago, Anthony Griffin out of Dallas, out of Galveston, represented for one of the Confederate guys.
I know,
KKK guy.
I was in the case where we got the KKK. He was the best lawyer to get the KKK permit to march down Westheimer.
But Christopher Wilkins would have had a problem with any lawyer representing him. So black, white, whatever. Because he seemed to be... starved for attention, and any attention, positive, negative, he just didn't care, and he wanted his moment of fame, and the spotlight was on him, so he took full advantage of it. Now, what do you do in terms of a lawyer? You're certainly trying to handle a client. You certainly don't want him to say anything that tends to incriminate him, and that's primarily what he did. I mean, he said, look, I really wanted to just go ahead and plead guilty to the jury. He's being tried for capital murder of two people. And he introduces himself, another murder. The fact that, I killed somebody else, too. And I tried to kill
By
some
the
others.
Way.
He tried to kill two other people
right.
a week after. Yeah.
So he's doing whatever he can to incriminate himself. So what does a lawyer do? You advise your client not to testify, clearly. But if he decides that the decision to testify is solely the client's decision. So what does a lawyer do? You're trying in this instance to save his life. And secondarily, you do have to have some concern about saving your own reputation in terms of what do I do in order to let it be known that I gave the right kind of advice. Now, do I put this on the record in open court before the judge that my client and I have a conflict with one another, that would probably prejudice the judge a little bit against your client if that can even be done. But at some point, the lawyer has to make it clear. It would be helpful for the lawyer to make it clear in case the client claims you didn't tell it. So there are various ways of doing that. I mean, I guess you could write out all of the various risks that present themselves to him should he testify, and should he testify in a certain way, and just have that written out and have a witness there with you and have him sign that. That at least keeps it away from the judge and out of the record at that point. Then later on, if he signed it or if he refused to sign, just have to refuse to sign. When the writ lawyer comes to interview you, you could at least say, well, you know, this is what I told him.
Sure. Was there ever a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel filed in this case?
Only by him.
Well,
okay.
There was a claim at the federal level, and there was at a state level.
Right.
At the federal level, they made that claim, but not at the state level.
Okay.
What he claimed is he got the case kicked back to the Court of Criminal Appeals on his direct appeal lawyer. What had happened when the case went up on direct appeal, he accused a trial lawyer of having taken care of one of the witnesses or something to that effect, and they kicked it back down to the lower court, to the trial court, to decide whether or not it should have a new lawyer appointed on direct appeal. But there was never an ineffective point raised in direct appeal or in the state writ. It only came up during the federal writ, which, of course, was waived because it wasn't brought up in the state.
Right, right.
Max will discuss the ineffective part.
Okay.
Oh, by the way, one thing that Paige didn't get a chance to mention, when the jury came back with the death sentence, one of the jurors, a couple of them were crying, he whispered to him, "It's okay, it's okay." So after they gave him the death penalty.
He seemed to want to appear to be in control of everything that went on in the courtroom, and even
is this? I mean, you know what this reminds you of? Henry Lee.
Yeah. Well, what's funny, Ray, he also confessed to a bunch of murders he didn't do while he was in jail, claiming he wanted to get out and go investigate looking for bodies. Where he did the same thing Henry Lee Lucas
did.
He tried the same trick.
But Henry got a tour out of it.
Well, that's what he was trying to do himself. He was confessing. That's exactly why he did it.
Do you think this show is responsible for
No, I don't think
because I talked about Henry Lee on the other show.
No.
But again, even that brings more attention to him.
Yes.
And he was desperately seeking attention.
Henry Lee, I mean, so you know who we're talking about, Henry Lee Lucas. And Google him. I mean, there's a lot in there about Henry Lee Lucas. They had him charged with murders from Who Laid a Chunk, from Washington State.
The difference, though, Ray, in this case, they investigated the murders and they didn't file anything. This is all nonsense.
Yes, it's all nonsense. But while they were investigating, Henry got out and traveled all over the country and ate steaks with detectives. I don't know if that would help my appetite a lot, but Henry Lee Lucas did it. And this is the same story. Are we as a society neglecting people to a terminal degree? What is it about these people who need attention? I mean, my God, they even run for president these days.
Go back to what they said. Plato said years ago, the child is the father of the man.
Okay.
But he was seeking attention so that even during the trial, he's complaining about the thing that his lawyer did. So there was he underscored whatever conflict he had in his mind in terms of what the lawyer was doing to him. For instance, he said that the lawyers were trying to, he said, look, I really wanted to plead guilty, but they were trying to add up billable hours. And he also complained that the lawyers, to defend him, called his family to testify for him and to keep the jury from returning a death sentence. He complained about that, saying, you know, I didn't want my family
coming down here to beg
for my life. And then flipped it with thanking the prosecutor for not cross-examining his family, saying that I don't think I could have taken that. Okay, so he's trying to be in control.
He knew what the system was, and he was trying to use the system, but it didn't work.
Well, when you say didn't work, he
outside of
was trying to use the system to bring attention to himself, and if bringing attention to himself cost him his life, he seemed to think that that was a fine price to pay. I mean, he kept piling it on. I haven't been worth anything for the last 20 years, probably won't for the next 20 and the 20 after that. So he was there asking, he was seeking the death penalty is what he was doing. Now, what can we as a society do for someone who commits offenses like killing that many people and then come forward and says, give me the death penalty? You know, what do you do?
Same thing they did in South Carolina.
Yeah.
Apparently, they're going to oblige him.
Yep.
Apparently.
Larry. Mike Gillespie, what have we got? What's your piece of this puzzle? Get close to that microphone.
My piece of the puzzle is to talk about the council and the inefficiency of council. And this is a classic case of, let's talk about the law. The law says that a lawyer efficiency has got to be a cause of harm. And what that means is, in cases of held, lawyer comes to court and tries the case drunk.
Yep.
Lawyer comes to court and falls asleep. As long as he would have been found guilty anyway, that's not a reversible error.
Yeah, that helped Joe Cannon a lot.
Yeah, and this is a case in which, as I was going to go through all the things he said, and Paige did a better job than I could do, there's no way he could win this case. He's in there asking that he dies. He's asking there asking to be killed. He's asking to tell me he doesn't care. There's nothing a lawyer could have done to different. There's nothing a lawyer could have done to help him. Now, the interesting question that I have on this is him testifying. I mean, this is tricky. He comes up there and he kills himself. As a lawyer, do you let a client take the stand when you know they're going to say things like, I don't care if I live or die? The other case Jim mentioned, you guys don't convict me, I'm going to come back and kill all of you. Why would you put your client on the stand to have him say something like that?
Well, does the lawyer really have say in that?
If you're his lawyer, you better have say in that.
Michael, that is the defendant's choice. The lawyer can't
stop
me.
No, it's his say that. But as your lawyer, your job is to communicate with your client.
You can admonish your butt off.
Now, some things about this that I would have done different, okay? First of all, the safe way to do this is to have your client be informed of what the choices are, make sure he knows it's his decision to make, make sure you advise him against it, and the proper procedures, have a witness over there that you told him these things, and so you have the witness that you warned him not to do it. My problem with that is that sometimes, and this guy's a prime example, we'll talk next about his statement he gave later, this guy gives a damning indictment on Texas Youth Commission. And he basically says that when you're in there, you got to be tough to survive. My problem with being a holdover cell, it's hard for a guy to be weak in the holdover cell. To put a client among other prisoners and ask him these questions, he almost has to be tough and say, take it to trial, I don't care. My advice would be to take him in the courtroom, put him away from the jail people, put him out there in front of the judge in the courtroom he will be into and see how he talks in a room that he's not comfortable with rather than in a holdover cell where he's around all the people he's going to be with for a long period of time.
Okay, you're talking about the holdover cell during trial.
During trial.
Okay. Shouldn't you have had this conversation in the lawyer's booth prior to trial?
Of course you should have this in the private conference room. In the private conference room in the jail. But still, the jail is his territory. I'm saying in the courtroom is your territory. Okay. Sometimes that big courtroom with the American flags and the bailiffs and the process service can be
in
intimidation to show that this is serious, that this is not just talk in a jail cell, that you're now in open court and there's a judge, and I want you to tell the open court how you want to testify against my opinion. Either way works. But from my viewpoint, having him in open court puts him more in the territory. Now, the other thing about this that I find interesting is his mental condition. Is there an argument to say that somebody who all the facts are against him and you want to get mercy is sometimes letting him testify so the jurors can really see what we're dealing with, to see the full side of the man? I mean, what he did is horrible. There's no way he's going to get any mercy. But I read his statement that he gave later, and I feel sorry for him. And I wonder if sometimes if a person is doomed to be found guilty anyway and is going to be executed, is the only chance a lawyer has is to humanize his client and let his client talk to the jury and let the jury see what they're dealing with and who they're killing? I'm not saying that's a proper procedure, but that's what I would do if he insists on testifying.
Well, if you're desperate enough, who cares about proper?
Well, if he wants to testify, you have to turn a negative to a positive, and the positive would be to show the human side of him and maybe some people. And I think when we hear the talk coming up about his statements, this guy touched me. What he talked about, what his life was like, bothered me. It doesn't excuse what he did, but it might make me want to give him life in prison rather than have him executed.
No, he didn't kill anybody on death row.
No.
And he's been there for several years.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right.
Well, what's interesting about this is the contrast between the person at trial and the contrast later in the stuff he put on Facebook. And that's why I added to this workup his statement he made on Facebook, and it's like two different
people.
Let's
set it up for that statement. What is, we refer to it as a statement, it's a letter.
Yeah, but what it is kind of like it's a long commentary about how he feels after he's been in prison, and it, you would have think it's two different people. What's really interesting is the contrast between what he said at jail and in prison, contrasted what he said later in this long, rather extensive Facebook article after he read a number of articles, and a lot of it probably is parroting what he had read, and Tim's going to talk about that, and Mike's going to add to that. But I think what's real interesting, you're talking about two different people almost, you know, like the good wolf, the bad wolf we've talked about before, because one of them was the good guy that came out. The problem is, Michael, was trying to get him to humanize in front of the jury. They did that. He humanized, but what he said would not work. It's entirely different than what he said in his letter. That was not what he would say in front of the jury. Because if you recall, he even talked when his family begged for his life. He was telling he didn't buy that BS himself. The jury shouldn't buy what the family said. So he did humanize him in the sense, but it wasn't a very good humanization characterization.
As a person who's never been in jail, my only punishment ever has only been detention or staying in a corner in school.
Yeah.
I always thought staying in a corner as a punishment meant to sit there and think about what you did.
Well, that's a good Quaker idea, yeah.
Well, that is as a young child I thought jail was. They lock you in a cell by yourself.
Actually, Mike, that's the concept, and I give a lot of lectures about Eastern State Penitentiary. Was built so that one could contemplate the error of their
ways. Well, penitence is based on penitence.
Yeah.
If that's the case, this letter we're going to talk about is an example of it.
Is an example of penitentiary.
And it's something I've always thought of. We've had a lot of shows here where we have talked to people on videos, and we have seen what happens, and we see a change in people. Carla Faye Tucker is one of them.
Oh, dozens of people that, I mean, as a matter of fact, I've been going to the radio, they never execute the person that they convict.
Here's an interesting question. Why don't we judge on death penalty years after the punishment of life in prison?
Well, or of course, if you had my preference, it wouldn't be in death penalty. But if we're going to have it delayed in the process and see what hath God wrought with this person?
We're not killing the same person who committed the crime.
In fact,
biology shows that our body changes every 60, 90 days. We have new cells by the food we eat. We're a totally different person. After 7 or 8 years, that's not the same person who committed this crime. We're killing somebody different.
Well, let's have Tim expose that. Tim?
Not all I can expose. You've done a really good job. It's very thorough and it's very heartwarming letter. And I think for the people that know him or love him, his family and friends, they found a lot of closure in this letter. He says he does come from them from hell, but now he's free. Now he comes to them in heaven, where he's at peace. He talks about his self-growth, spirituality. He went from an atheist to have seen the light. And it's kind of interesting to note that he's gone a long way in a very short period of time. He doesn't blame anybody. He goes on to say he's not blaming his mom, who beat him and abused him and drugged him, put him to sleep at night with NyQuil and whiskey, or his brothers who gave him crack cocaine and stuff. little bit closer? Okay. And or anybody else. He's not blaming nobody, the system. He's not blaming the system, but he should, obviously. And the teachers. But he is apologizing. He's finally found a point in his life that he feels safe, comfortable, and secure. And at peace, as he says, he's seen the light.
You think he wrote that, Tim, primarily for his family, or who do you think he wrote it for?
I think he wrote it for himself and for his family. Okay. Yes, I do. It's very heartwarming. It's very touching. It's a very intense letter. And so, yes, a closure for his family would be my bet, and a closure for himself. He goes on and claims that he does not believe in God. He's an atheist. But he talks about finding God, or finding...
Searching
for closure, searching for peace. And he comes to them in this letter from a place of peace. And he goes on to explain how he has done that, that's soul searching. And
did you get the impression this was a genuine? Because, see, a lot of this, if you recall, he thanked some number of writers after he wrote the letter. One of whom was Camus, who wrote The Stranger, and we all know that of the book on The Stranger was primarily about the way the person felt after he got the death sentence, was looking at death in the eye. And it's a great book on existentialism. And you think some of that, you think he was really sincere about it? He was just spouting off what he read. What do you think, Tim?
My thoughts on it are kind of mixed. Mm-hmm. I've read spirituality books, self-help books, some of the books that he's written, are along those lines of spirituality or New Age, I guess you would call it. And but they seem to be, in my opinion, of course, I think he's genuine.
Mike, do you think it was genuine, or do you think he was quoting somebody?
I think his words are universal in the soul of all men. It's a question of do men find it.
A little bit.
I think that solitude is what allows you to find it. And when we talked before about penance and being put alone.
Sure.
The key to that is when you're young. What this really is, an indictment of TYC, Texas Youth Commission. What he talks
about... No, you're never alone, Texas Youth Commission.
But what he talks about, what happened to him there...
There's you and the guy with the shank and the other
Mike,
guy.
Mike, if I can interrupt just a second. What was interesting, years ago when Will Gray was doing a lot of these death penalty cases, I was helping Will, and I went up to death row, and I was shocked because one-fourth to one-third of everybody on death row had been raised in reform school. And it's kind of got the impression they were like raised quail that you could later shoot. Because a majority, like I say, about a third or fourth of all these kids on death row had been gone through our youth center.
Jim, having thrown out that image, I have to tell the audience that whoever Christopher Wilkins had been and whoever he started out today is now dead. The state of Texas has executed Christopher Wilkins about 12 minutes ago. The witnesses have left the death chamber. The body will be transported to a little church not far from Huntsville, where his family will be able to touch it while it is still warm. And that sounds really, really morbid, but that's what they do, because if you're on death row, there are no contact visits. You have not had any human contact with anybody that cares about you for that whole period of time. And Carnes, who has the contract to remove the body from Huntsville and carry it to his facility in South Houston for burial preparations, realized that, and the old Baptist preacher, Carnes Sr., decided, I'm going to give the families an opportunity to touch a warm body before I carry it away. Mm. And that has happened today, about 15 minutes ago, to Christopher Wilkins.
Ray, I was just curious. You read the same statement we all read. Mike, I was not impressed with you because you guys were. Do you think that was a sincere redemption, or do you think that was a con?
I have to look at that through the eyes of a writer. Why would I write something like that? And I always write for a larger audience than myself, but it could be in the form of a written for himself confession. And how do I sort this out? I'm going to die anyway. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're going to kill me. I've got the sentence, and the clock is ticking loudly on the wall. So what am I going to do? And he may have written it for himself, which would, in my mind, make it even more honest than if he wrote it for anybody else.
And my point, and you've mentioned this to me before, if it's true or not, he said it.
Yeah.
If we have a purpose of this punishment for crime, the purpose is for people to come to that realization. And once they come to that realization, we have no business executing them.
But balance it with this. If you recall Truman Capote, who did the murder about the...
Yeah, in Cold Blood.
When they declared the death penalty unconstitutional, he went back to death row. And he said those people who were talking like this guy was talking his letter flipped over and kind of were more animalistic. In fact, you have two people. You have the person that wrote that letter. You have the perfect person that got in front of a jury and said, I'm no good, never will be any good. What happened when the death row sentence was lifted after Farmer versus Georgia came out, the people on death row, many of them reverted back to what he was in front of the jury as opposed to what he was during the letter once that was lifted. So I'm not too sure how good that
Reformation
is. A tiger
might not be able to change his stripes, but at least when it's trying, maybe trying to con us, but when it's trying to do right, it's sending a message to younger kids and other people in the penal system that this is... These could be role models, and even if they're not honest about it, they're role models. And a guy like him can relate to a young kid from the same environment better than you and me can.
I don't think a young kid would understand why he wrote in the letter, Mike.
No, I don't think so.
I think that.
No, the letter's more mature than that. The
letter's way over a kid's head.
Yeah.
Well, I grant that.
Yeah.
But in theory, to me, a man like that could be a good parole officer.
Jim's bringing up in Cold Blood and Truman Capote calls to mind that, in a very real sense, Truman Capote wrote that. And as he was writing it, I actually met him in New Orleans one time. It was a big deal, and Cold Blood's going to be the best novel ever written and the best screenplay produced from it and all that. Truman Capote was a braggart and a drunk. And I met him. But when he got through writing it, it killed him. In Cold Blood did not turn out the way Truman Capote wanted it to turn out, but he had the journalist gene. So he had to tell it as it actually was. He had fallen in love with a younger guy, and he was going to make the younger
guy... Dewey Smith is who he fell in love with.
He was going to exonerate Dewey, but he found out Dewey was really the stronger
Dewey
character.
Dewey was the one that did all the killing.
That, and was the stronger character in the two. And so he couldn't write a falsehood, so he wrote it accurately and proceeded to drug and drink himself to death.
But the reason I mention that, because it was amazing the difference in the personality change once people had the death sentence lifted off of them, because then they became the Christopher who was in front of the jury as opposed to the Christopher who wrote the letter. That's what I find to be interesting.
But is it wrong to not give people incentive to think right and do right? I mean, to give them...
I don't think it's an either-or situation. I love Jim and I love Mike like brothers, but the fact of the matter is any combination can play and any result can come out. While as there are those who reverted back to their animalistic drives and priorities, there are others, perhaps hopefully more, that get some traction in the new world and go on to more positive living. I think that one of the things that the death penalty does culturally is that it exaggerates the notion that we have disposable people. I think we have a lot of disposable people. We have disposable people in...
you just elected one, but go ahead.
Traffic stops where somebody gets needlessly shot for some chicken stuff misdemeanor. And are people that get ignored. And it always amazed me that all these lawyers down in the courthouse complex are working on human rights and human dignity and all of that, but they'll step over the feet and legs of a homeless person slumped up against the side of the building and never see them. But disposable people that are not significant enough to be that. And I've got a friend, Ben DeSoto, is working on a series of documentaries and still photographs about homelessness and poverty in Houston. When that comes out, I plan to use it as a weapon.
But, first of all, is this a statement that he's making any place available for the listening audience to read what we're talking about, or is this just on Facebook?
No, I think he's talking to himself, actually.
Okay, yeah. But is there any place where people who will listen to this can
answer
read
your question.
This?
It was posted on Facebook. If anyone wants a statement right here at the station, I'll send it to him.
No. It's going to be on our website.
Yeah,
Otis is working on it. It will accompany this broadcast. Excuse me. Paige just said it's already there.
Okay, good.
Thank you, Otis. We appreciate that.
Read the statement. And I'm telling asking the audience, isn't that what in our Christian hopes we hope that people who come
Mike,
from his...
Don't bang on the table. You keep banging on the table, but please.
Isn't that what we as Christians hope that people who committed sin comes to realize and change their ways before they go?
I think we all hope that. I think we all hope that the human experience will magnify and grow into something that we would define as positive.
So as Christians, when they do what we think they should do, we then execute them.
Well, I don't, yeah, I say we would execute once this ball starts rolling. There's no stopping it. I mean, that's the hard part about executions is it happened back in a courtroom. 8-9 years ago?
He's been on death row 9 years.
Okay, 8-9 years ago, it happened in a courtroom. And once that started, unless they can find something wrong with the process, but something right with him is not an issue. It is the process that is judged from that point forward. And I want to encourage the listeners to Execution Watch to examine our webpage. I hope that we can somehow get you to see what we do through our eyes. It's not easy for Jim and Mike and Miss Jack, glad to have Paige and Larry to come down here and anguish over a resolved case, trying to explain it to it. It's an exercise, not an intellectual, because somebody just died. This is not an intellectual procedure. This is a real procedure, and it's an action, from my point of journalism. It's a journalistic performance to help you better understand what is being done under your name and at your finance and expense if you're a taxpayer of any kind. So I think you need to know that. And here is an example. And Mike is more animated about this than some of the rest of us, but his animation comes from good old Catholic upbringing. A lot of Irish is a Catholic. Don't hold it against him.
I think it's the whiskey, but go ahead.
Okay, well, it's the same stuff. All of that's Irish, isn't it? But the deal is what happens if the person seeks redemption into a void where there is no one to grant redemption? It's between he and his Lord, and he doesn't believe in the Lord, so it's between him and nobody, because there's nothing in the system to respond to the changed person on death row. And the amazing thing, Mike, is the guys on death row are listening intently and with rapt attention to what we're doing here. The people that are in the pot waiting for it to warm up, like the frog who doesn't notice, is listening to what we're doing here. This is a very important show to people on death row.
I might never have said why I'm on this show.
Yeah.
But my belief for the death penalty is very simple. Punishment delayed is punishment denied. If Johnny grabs a gun and robs a store and Johnny is killed on the scene, Johnny screwed up. But when Johnny gets arrested and Johnny goes to court and Johnny is executed 10, 15 years later, it's the system, it's the lawyer, it's the judge. The only purpose of the death penalty is the detriment from other people. There's a chilling effect in the neighborhood when Johnny screwed up. Johnny took a gun and Johnny got killed. But when the government does it,
well,
that's not an indication of Johnny's action that causes death. That's our action that causes death, and that's not right.
I hear you.
Let me tell you.
But when you're Johnny's mother, he's a funeral.
I hear you.
Let me tell you the most logical argument I've ever heard against the death penalty. Scott Thoreau, who did a lot of books on crime, was a U.S. prosecutor, and he was the one that in Chicago led a task group when they decided to change all the death penalty sentences to life. He led that task group. And at the beginning of the task group, all were in favor of the death penalty. At the end of the interview, they all were opposed to it, not because of the reasons you've given, but here's what they said. And this, to me, makes a lot of logical sense. He said, we're not saying that people have not committed acts that forfeited their right to live. They've done some horrible things, and they should accept responsibility for their conduct. Our problem is we haven't learned to do it right. It's not that people haven't committed heinous acts that forfeit their right to walk on the planet Earth. The question is, how do we as a society do it fairly? For example, 20 counties in this nation have sent everybody on death row. Only 20 counties. You're much more likely to get killed in these smaller counties. If you're a woman, you do not get the death penalty. If you're a man, you do. As I've said many times before, if Andrea Gates was Andy Gates, he'd been dead now. Mm-hmm. And it's, the thing is, it's not that... We got to understand that a lot of people who are for the death penalty have the feeling you should pay for your consequences of your conduct. That's a logical, fair argument. The question is, and why Thoreau, all of them at the end of this, they disagree with the death penalty because they felt like they just couldn't do it right. For example, if you're in Louisiana in a street in a parish outside of Shreveport, you're going to get the death penalty. If you're living in California, you're not going to get the death penalty. So we just haven't, as a society, learned how to handle that. And that's why they were all opposed to the death penalty, because we haven't learned to handle it fairly and correctly.
And whatever they do in death penalty cases affects the laws that affect other cases. Some principles are established. Mm-hmm. And there is an axiom that says bad cases make bad law.
What's that old thing in the Bible? Be not deceived. God is not mocked. Whatsoever man soweth, that he shall also reap. That's the argument for the death penalty. But the question is, how do you do it fairly and do it honestly? And that's the real problem.
In this letter, Jim, he goes on to talk about how hell is actually a state of mind. Mm-hmm. And he goes on again.
Sounds like a married man, doesn't it, Tim?
It's not in your backyard, your man cave. But no matter where you are, is an act of love and a state of mind.
That's called a divorce, but go ahead.
Okay, now. But I forgot what I was going to say.
All right, Jim.
Well, that's Jim's role in here, to throw us a little off.
He was talking about love, and it actually freaked him out. He actually said in his letter that talking about love actually freaked him out. And that tells me there that he has come
He may have
somewhere.
Never known any of anything that resembles
never.
Love in his
that,
whole life.
At 13 years old, you know, during that, he was being swatted around and kicked and hit, and the parents didn't understand him.
Mike is cocked in love. What's going on, Mike?
I just, after reading that, I blame Texas Youth Commission.
I think you're right, Mike, because, you know, when you take a young kid and do what they've done to him in TYC,
exactly.
It is horrible. Yeah. I mean, you create criminals
and
by doing that.
I've represented people from it, and I hear it. What happened to him is disgraceful.
The what they used to call building tenders in Texas prison were the club of kids that graduated from Texas Youth Commission.
He, in his letter, he mentions that, and I can't repeat it on the air because it's not good. But
strong.
He says you either have to or fight.
Yeah,
you have to fight and be aggressive to live.
Of course, you're
or she can be a girlfriend.
You understood, Jim.
And he found stabbing was much more efficient.
Yeah, you know, Jim, you have the only one. As Jermaine Greer, there's got to be more to it than all that dreadful poking.
It's either a knife or stay out of the shower.
So. Yeah, exactly.
No,
literally, then.
Wait a minute. I was sentenced to 106 years. I went to prison. I'm openly gay. I was in prison. I didn't have any of that. And people would, you know, get romantic, and I'd say, are you crazy? I didn't come here to get a husband. I want a husband with a portfolio, not one with a prison number. I've already got one of those. No, you could.
That was your feminine side coming out.
It was my feminine
there
side.
I hate to tell you.
Yeah, right. Looking for the portfolio. I never did find that guy. Inside or out. But
remember what the lady said. The guy said, would you love me if I was broke? She said, yes, and I sure would miss you too. So keep that in mind.
We laugh in here sometimes. And what do you do? I think probably Christopher would give us that leeway, because Christopher become philosophical around. I hope you will go to the website. I hope all of you will read Christopher's letter.
Yes.
And I hope when you do that, you will see what we deal with. There's the music's playing. I got to do that.
I want to thank Tim for being here.
Thank you very much.
Well, I'm just going to thank
Tim. And he did find peace at the end.
My name is Ray Hill, and you've been listening to Execution Watch tonight. And Execution Watch tonight, they killed Christopher Wilkins, and he is now deceased. Just like Larry told you was going to happen in this hour. Legal team is Jim Skelton. Thank you for riding herd, Jim, on all these folks. Larry Douglas, Mike Gillespie, Paige Janik, our good friend Mike Jack Lee got to lay in tonight. He's got important cruises to go on or something. I'm going to thank Tim Bass for coming in and providing us some insight into the voice of Christopher Wilkins. I want to thank Jennifer Simmons for her coverage of the Houston demonstration and congratulate them on the population of that. As always, I want to thank Pat Hartwell for having the fortitude to go all the way to Huntsville and witness all of these things. That is not easy. Our executive producer is Elizabeth Stein, and you can get in touch with her at elizteksusa@gmail.com. Technical director Otis McClay, who's already done work on this broadcast. Bob Gardner is our board operator and general producer, and the music you hear is Victoria Panetti, and you can get in touch with Victoria at She Monster International or myspace.com/SheMonster. You can get in touch with me by looking telephone director in Houston. My name is Ray Hill, or you can email me at hillray@sbcglobal.net. This is, as always, an experience that we do not want to have. We thank you for your patience of putting up with us.